You are listening to Latin Waves, a weekly syndicated program. For more information about our program, visit www.latinwavesmedia.com. Latin Waves Media is also now available on Twitter at Twitter/Latin Waves Media. And now for the conclusion of the interview with Robin Hanel.
There's two things that come to mind when you're speaking about the ability for a government to simply print money to pay their debts. And, you know, the case of Hungary comes to mind, where the IMF is imposing austerity measures as a way to deal with their deficit. The case of Greece, where people are saying, no, we're not going to give up our pensions to pay for this. We didn't spend this money. We didn't, you know, gamble this money. So why should we pay for it? And then I think of the case of Venezuela, where the government has nationalized their banks, is funding projects that address needs in their community. And the difference that has made in terms of putting quotas on how much people can charge for things that people need. So inflation can also be something that seems to me governments can manage in a way that is not harmful to their population. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
That's absolutely true. The first sort of myth is, if the money supply increases, then that necessarily will create inflation. No. Inflation comes when we have sort of high levels of demand for goods and services compared to the supply of goods and services that's out there. Well, that's not the situation we find ourselves in. In the greatest recessions in 80 years, we are not about to have inflation. Everybody who's running around worrying about inflation because the money supply is increasing are absolutely out of their minds. There's one member of the Federal Reserve Board here in the United States, the Kansas City Federal Reserve Bank, you know, who is just pontificating on the subject that he's not voting for the things that the Federal Reserve is doing right now because it's going to create inflation. Our problem is going to be deflation, prices that start to fall, price levels falling, rather than inflation in the near future. The second thing is, if inflation did come, there are plenty of things that governments can do about it. And you're right, the Venezuelan government is a very good example. The Nixon administration put in wage price controls. So you can implement sort of government temporary policies that control prices, you know, if the inflation should arise. But anybody who is worried about inflation, any place on the planet today, is absolutely out of their minds. They're a crackpot, and they don't deserve to be listened to. There is no evidence that inflation is likely to rear its ugly head any place. Instead, the major problem in that regard is falling prices that have a further depressing effect on the economy rather than inflation.
The question is, why then would a government like the U.S., rather than nationalize their debt and invest in projects that address needs, like fixing the levees in New Orleans, like fixing bridges and, you know, investing in school systems that are public or hydroelectric projects that are publicly owned, chooses to continue to fund private banks?
It's capitalist ideology. There are people out there who refuse to admit that the private sector sometimes cannot do things as well as the public sector can. Instead, they want to argue just the opposite. They want to say the public sector should do nothing because the private sector does it more. And what you're suggesting is, well, here we have a patent failure of the private sector, in this case the private financial sector, to perform the socially useful services that we need from a financial sector. And it's not that complicated for the government to go into that business and do it better. Well, you know what the standard objection is. We don't want the government going into business and competing with private business. And that's what it comes down to. Wall Street doesn't want the government to out-compete them, to replace them. They don't want to compete with government banks doing good things. And they don't want the government to replace them. It's the same as the medical insurance industry. We know that paying for health care, you certainly know it in Canada, a majority of us here in the United States, the actual citizens of the United States, know that it is much more efficient to pay for health care through a single insurer that is a government agency, rather than having an entire private medical insurance industry out there. But, of course, the private medical insurance industry is making humongous profits. They don't want to give that up, so they keep screaming and yelling that it's terrible and it's bad and it's unacceptable for the government to replace them. That's the only argument against having the government come into and play a major role in the financial industry because the private sector has proven itself to be so incompetent. That's the argument, and our answer to that argument is basically very simple and straightforward. No, there are certainly clear-cut areas, even in a capitalist economy, where the public sector is far better suited to providing those services than the private sector is. We have plenty of empirical evidence to demonstrate that, both in healthcare and now in finance. These are the two areas where it's absolutely clear that these should not be left to the private sector. But they keep screaming, you have to leave it to us because we do it better, even though they don't. And the reason they keep screaming that is because they are making profits. While they're screwing up, they're making really large profits.
Most of the military coups in Latin America have meant the privatization of public-owned entities like hydroelectric networks, the public health, public school systems. And, you know, this has created an incredible, I guess not just inequitable situation where we're seeing hunger increasing in places like El Salvador. Over 50% of people cannot feed themselves, you know, on a regular basis. In Haiti, we have a population that is, you know, the poorest in the region, and it's now occupied under the same premises of, you know, a people who refuse to accept these policies of neoliberalism or privatization. So how do we change our ideology? What do we need to do to create a culture of resistance? Because it seems to me those policies are coming from Western countries like the U.S., Canada, France, you know, developed industrialized countries. So it seems to me the change needs to happen here before we can stop invading other countries and causing terrible harms.
We have to battle against the ideology that private multinational corporations actually run the world in a very efficient and fair way. We have to basically say, that's the lie. That's the big lie, and what they will end up doing predictably will be contrary to the social interest, and then we have tremendous empirical evidence of massive failures. You're absolutely right. In the 80s and the 90s, the IMF, you know, neoliberal agenda, the Washington Consensus, one of the components of the programs that was literally shoved down the throats of unwilling governments in Latin America and in the rest of the third world was privatization. You had a public sector. It could be electricity. It could be water, the famous example of water in Bolivia. And the IMF came in and said, no, this is bad economics. Governments don't run things well. Private sector runs it better. In the case of the water system in Bolivia, they said not only does the private sector run it better, but a foreign company, Bechtel, will run it far better. But that turned out not to be the case. They ran it far better in the sense that they figured out a way to make a handsome profit for the stockholders in Bechtel, but they decreased the access to water for a substantial portion of the poor population, and they jacked up the rates that everybody had to pay to an obscenely unfair level. And yet that was the kind of stuff that that the IMF was peddling and forcing governments to do. Well, it's simply an example of policies, in this case international economic policies, that are simply favoring the takeover of, you know, important services by private multinational corporations if they happen to be in the hand of some sort of public agencies in the first place. Now, there is a small problem here. I'm sure that we can all, well, certainly the people who were arguing that had no trouble finding examples where public corporations in third world countries were not being run as efficiently as they should have been, and in fact were also being used as a kind of political patronage system for the, you know, politicians in office. Well, that doesn't just happen in third world countries. Crony capitalism happens everywhere. The biggest example of crony capitalism is the U.S. government, you know, basically serving as crony capitalism for Wall Street. Now, over a long period of time, and most obviously in the last few years in terms of the sort of money they have been doling out to them. So you can make a case that we needed reform, you know, of the public water providing system in Bolivia, that it was not the best system it could be. Finding examples of corruption and political patronage, that's not the same as making a general case that on average, that in terms of utilities, publicly operated utilities on average work better. In terms of finance, publicly operated financial institutions generally work better. Certainly in the case of medical insurance, they work better. We have to make the case that in capitalism, there are major areas of the economy where public ownership and management is in the public's interest.
Thank you so much for joining us. My guest is Robin Hennell. His upcoming book is Green Economics Confronting the Ecological Crisis, which should be out soon. Tell us, how soon can people expect your book?
It should be available in December, so it's only a few months away, and it's with Emmy Sharp as the publisher, and I'm looking forward to it because we've got some important meetings coming up in Cancun where, once again, the world is going to attempt to address climate change. Things don't look good, but it's a really important time for people to start thinking clearly on this issue, and I hope the book will help people do that.
Thank you again for joining us.
Very good to be with you.
Take care.
África, Brasil, diretamente do mundo frio, Canadá, é nóis que tá. Nomadic Massi, Universal Home, do Haiti ao Canadá, do Brasil ao Iraque, vai segurando.
You hear me say, yo, burn them, cause them a burn you too. Ay, run them, cause them a try fi run you, try and turn you fool on. Leave you fi dead when they fill up you head with them dibby dibby talk and them dibby dibby walk. Watch how you gone, you didn't know where you did them. Sin, kneel down and pray while them stand up and take for your food, for your spirit, pan your back house and make keep your hole, make them feel it, yo. Dig for them soul and build back for your quarter. Eat for them food, stay on track, drink your water. It don't make no sense, you running after one man's dream is the next man's disaster. Dash way in my hands, if I can't, if you fun, you live strong and galang, bout your business. Seen this, no move, no growth, soon you guy live by your own shine. And not no, gimme line, fit they give your mind, pan them, giddy grind. Why you losing time? And feel your pick me losing fit me, case I make harder. They moving circles, we moving forward.
We have this head on,
so when you sit on your side,
I'm dripping like cold.
So we get your night like a ball.
All them wicked shall fall.
Yeah, bad man fall.
It's not that man you should call.
No way, no way.
We moving forward,
just like a bird.
We crashing them walls,
like the first one.
Let's just live it and fall.
Man, pas mes laquais, Batman, Timantine, Paladin. Nomadic, c'est Selvan, pas Jean-Von à la prenne. C'est le singe, Copyman, sort de là, on n'en qu'à combien de fois notre rack a des espoirs. Sans blague, on follow la mérite, on courait, qu'on promesse, qu'on polémique, polémique, on manque. Crée ton propre chemin, décoller n'en plein. Défendre trois aux anticorps ou mon cher ou trois malins. Nomadic, Africa, on voyage en bus de bus. Customs office, get the best of us, forget the bus, bus it. On avance sous les sangs, boulet dans la foule et laisse la vibe couler, oublie ceux qui joue les fous, la laisse le poison, les sous, les roules, les sur l'or, c'est pas l'objectif. Casse la boîte, sort dehors, hors subjectif, sélectif. Connect the right projects, got a flea market full of it. Lift every rock, toute une vérité à soulever. Recto sin escala, quien nos para, palante sin pena. Sin edición, crudo, no tengas miedo, prueba. Levanta el orgullo, do you, sois toi-même, être humain libre. Je vais où le vent m'amène.
Je fonctionne, selon mes fonctions.
Bust the move and it's work, serve words with nerve.
Ain't no way that the crowd can sit down.
We have his hand on,
so we can see through the visor.
Time gripping like gold,
so we can unite like a pole.
All them wicked shall fall.
Yeah, bad man fall.
It's not that man you should call.
No way, no way.
We moving forward,
just like a bird.
We crashing them walls,
like the bird.
Let's just pivot and go,
so we can all shine.
Cause we shed his hand on.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
África pra trabalhar essa lama lá. Basta acreditar que você pode chegar lá. Atravessando geleiras, vencendo os desertos, quebrando barreiras, transcendendo os dialetos. Já blessing, relaxa aliciai, a jazambiorai, rastaforai, ensinamento haitiano. É o canto patuá, oxalá, vou lá, porque eu bata lá. Mistura bata cubano com chuva de Trinidad. É nós que dá, o povo daqui, o povo que vem de lá. Africano, guerreiro sou já, pra hoje pra Iemanjá, no toque de Iemanjá.
We use the present day moment to recreate the past. All facts, we autograph that on wax and speed the brass. You slow the cash, now why try like wireless Wi-Fi? We connect back to back just like Echo. Pro bono de aquí hasta el sol del Rio. Nous campé con les sous-eau, tant qu'ou presse griot. Simon retracé, vérité, nous quel nassin. Tout m'a changé, masquel, un marché, vous ne rivez.
We have his head on. I'm gripping like gold,
so we can unite like a pole.
All them wicked shall fall.
Yeah, bad man fall.
It's not that man you should call.
No way, no way.
We moving forward,
just like a bird.
We crashing them walls.
smash it and roll.
Fight the world and war.
Lift your spirit and call.
So we can all shine.
Cause we share the same blood.
That was the incredible lyrics of Nomadic Massive and their melody, Moving Forward. For more information on their music, go to myspacenomadicmassive.org. We are very privileged to have Alan Sears. He is the author of Retooling the Mind Factor and frequent contributor to The New Socialist. He's also a professor and has challenged us to look at socialism in the 21st century. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Now, beginning with the question of socialism, what is socialism?
Yeah, no, thanks for asking, because I think it's one of those words that means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And to me, the central idea of it is collective and democratic power from below. So people actually with their own hands collectively and democratically taking control over their workplace, over government, over their communities, and so on. And to me, that's the absolute core of socialism is democratic and collective control.
One of the key concepts that you challenge us to look at is the construct of society. And many people have argued that in society there are those who believe in the order, assuming authority as the truth, and there are others who see conflict, those movements of resistance, the challenge and force us to evolve. What are the steps, I guess, to creating this collective power from below that you're speaking about?
Yeah, no, and I think it's a real challenge right now because that collective power ebbs and flows. You know, there's times when it really builds. And so the first thing is that people in their own lives, with their own bodies, in their own communities, recognizing that something's wrong and engaging in fight backs in various ways. And that happens all the time and is absolutely essential. And at the same time, people also need a vision that goes beyond the immediate situation that they're in, a sense of how you could actually change the world, a sense in participating in a bigger project of transforming the world and so on. And so it's that combination between the immediate thing of people recognizing what's going on, doing their own analysis and figuring out their own situation, and a broader thing of people uniting together in new ways. And that happens, I mean, it's happening right now around migrant justice. It happens in all kinds of different ways. But it also ebbs and flows. And so we're at a time right now where overall the capacity for fight back is more limited than it's been, say, 20, 25 years ago. And yet we're facing huge attacks. So part of the challenge is how do we rebuild that?
One of the areas that I'm particularly interested in is the issue of education and how education has contributed and sometimes stalled the process of social development and social movements. As in the academy, you are asked to look at the world from a theoretical perspective, from an abstract concept-based position where you're supposed to be objective. How do you define this line of objectivity that, in my opinion, prevents real discourse?
Yeah, no, I agree with you completely, and I think if you look at the education system, it does the opposite of what real education would do a lot of the time. It encourages people to doubt what they already know rather than build on what they already know, and to doubt what they learn through their own experience and their bodies and their lives as opposed to what they learn from the outside. It uses force to make people learn, whereas learning is actually the most natural thing. And I agree with you that it substitutes these ideas like objectivity for knowledge based in our own real experience and our own points of view. And so it's a huge thing to challenge that in various ways. And I agree with you about the way that in places like academia, the idea that you need this new kind of knowledge that comes from these specialists, that comes from books, and that overwhelms any knowledge that people already have from their own experience is a huge challenge. So to me, part of the challenge is finding our own spaces for education, doing our own kinds of education, finding cracks in the system, and eventually using transformative power to change our whole conception of education.
So where do we begin this process? Because in order for us to create transformative change in society, we need to acknowledge that something is wrong. Eduardo Galeano says we need to begin by looking at reality as it is, mm-hmm. and then imagining and creating something, an alternative version to it. So where do we begin? Because in society right now, we have many myths about how our economy operates, about what poor people or how they became poor, and this naturalism of the economy and the world. Where do you challenge those concepts, and how do you begin a transformative change?
No, I think that's really important to think about. Now, on the one hand, I think we do have myths, as you're talking about. You know, that the myth, just for example, that people who are dealing with poverty are the authors of their own problem, and that the system is fundamentally just and fair and all that kind of stuff. And I think often, though, it's not that everyone simply buys into those myths. I think often people have their own questions about the way things actually work and are not simply accepting the system fully, but the problem is often they have doubts, they have questions, but the sense that something else is possible, that another way of living is possible, based on our own power, based on democracy, and so on, is so far from what a lot of people experience that it's hard to move between the doubts that people have about those myths and the possibility of a better way of living. And I think part of our challenge right now is to figure out ways to get people involved in ways of recognizing how their own struggles can be part of a broader struggle to change the world as a whole, and to understand how their own questions can be part of bigger questions that that help us understand the possibility for alternative ways of living. And that means drawing on things that we've learned through the last 150 years of struggle, like some ideas of socialism and so on, but also being open to new questions and new ways of thinking, and not simply thinking that the answers are in the past.
You speak about how the increasing polarization of the workforce has been naturalized through racism and sexism. And I would add another element to this, and that has been the legitimization of institutions and structures like the WTO or the IMF, or structures that have contributed to the exploitative patterns of capitalism and neoliberalism. How do we challenge these false power dominance hierarchies that we have maintained for so many years and that now have almost a life of their own?
Mm-hmm. No, it's really important. And I think part of the thing is that it does happen that when people begin to fight back, they do find new ways of making alliance with one another. And I'm not saying that that in itself is sufficient, but that's an important part of it, is recognizing that people do build creative alliances in struggles and suddenly recognize a commonality with other people who are losing out in various ways in the system. But that in itself is only part of it. It's also necessary to be raising questions about the way things are and challenging especially the way things like whiteness and masculinity and heterosexism and the imperial dominant position get taken for granted, so that often people just assume that that's the way things are. Mm-hmm. And I think it's only through the combination of people beginning to fight back and recognizing they can do that and carrying on lots of discussion and debate about these issues that you can both achieve transformation through practice and through people raising new questions about that kind of reality.
In Vancouver, we are facing serious issues of gentrification and impoverishment. What message would you have to people who are seeing their rights eroded?
Yeah, no, and both the combination between the crackdown on dissent and the criminalization of poverty go together here, and that's not just a Vancouver pattern, but a broader pattern across North America and around the world in various ways. The problems are huge ones: the right to decent housing, the right to a level of social assistance that keeps people actually alive at a decent level, and the right to free expression, and the right to be poor and on the street, as opposed to harassed by police and so on. These are huge challenges.
Thank you so much for being with us. Alan Sears, the author of Retooling the Mind Factory and frequent contributor to the New Socialist. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Cambia lo superficial, cambia también lo profundo.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.